Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Greek default is really looking likely. Stocks in the U.S. finally break their six-week losing streak. Harry Dent is our guest today, and lots more coming on episode 217 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, welcome and happy Father's Day to all of you out there. This is episode 217. It's almost the summer solstice already of June. Wow, time is flying this year. We're talking about the week starting June 20th, 2011, episode number 217, and there is so much going on around the world that it's almost, you know, right now I feel like, I don't know, it's like trying to drink a sip of water out of an open fire hydrant or something, because it's just amazing the amount of information that is coming out daily, not only throughout Europe and China and Japan, I mean, just all over the place. Amazing amount of craziness, frankly. But we're going to talk about some of this, and we're going to go through some of the things that I think that are going to be very helpful when looking at this market over the near, and we'll call it the midterm, because right now it almost seems, I don't know if you've noticed this, but every single comment, economic outlook, or report that comes out is market moving. It moves the currency, the equity markets. It has the ability to take something from a 1% move up to flat in a matter of an hour or less. And this is the world that we're living in right now that is, it has really been a governmental push with incredible amounts of liquidity. And the questions that are now looking like, well, did the economy really get any better, or was it just the stock market? We're going to get to that. We're also going to talk with Harry Dent. We haven't talked to him in a while. He's a great guest, good friend, and we're going to have to find out what he thinks about his prognosis, because he's been pretty bearish in the longer term, although he has a couple of bouts of being bullish here and there, as I read a lot of his materials. But I think that we want to find out what really is going on with this whole concept of depression or recession, or what's happening here. Greenspan came out last week, and he talked about how he thought that the European region was going to be absolutely feeling a default by Greece, a very likely default by Greece. Greece really essentially has run out of money. And you may be asking yourself, you know, what does Greece have to do with us here? It's not really Greece. It's the bigger picture. It's the lack of ability of the European zone and the Eurozone and European region to really be combating what has been, in my opinion, a very bad decision that they made a decade or so ago. You know, before there was the euro, the clear problems that they were experienced throughout the region was that there was difficulty in trading because currencies were separate. There was different trading rules, et cetera. And by bringing in a single currency, they were able to really just allow for a much freer level of trade without worry about having pricing disparities due to currency changes. One of the big things that I never really understood, and I always had a real problem with, and I think it was a very bad decision, was that that may be true, but there's a bigger issue out there when you look at how now each individual country is still managed within their own economy. So you have Germany, and you have France, and you have Greece, and Italy, etc. Each is an individual economy. But their currencies are all tied together. Therefore, the adjustment of currencies really is not going to be so much helpful to the countries that are very weak, if there's a bunch of those, versus those that are strong. Prime example is that the euro is strong right now, where you have a multitude of countries that are on a brink of potential default. Whereas you have some strong countries, or stronger, like Germany, France, that are holding that all up, because they have the ability to do so. In fact, if you really think about it, without Germany and France, this whole thing would have gone kaput a long time ago. But they need to protect the currency and the region entirely, as does China. China's number one trading partner is Europe. That's why they've been busy propping up the euro. The more they prop up the euro, the more expensive the euro becomes, the more inexpensive their goods become for export or import into Europe. There's a lot of artificial movement happening right now. There's a lot of manipulation that's going on. And I say that in a way that it on both sides of the bad sort of manipulation that we see that's being done in the media and the level of, we'll say, rhetoric that's being spoken and spewed on a daily basis. Just look at Greece. You know, just last week they talk about a major reshuffling of the cabinet because the current prime minister is facing a major vote of confidence or lack of confidence. So the decision is made to, we're going to reshuffle the cabinet. They moved two people around. One person was moved to another position and one person was let go. I mean, that is not a reshuffling. The problem is that Greece has gotten away with this. Now, I'm not saying that it's the entire Greece. I'm talking about the current establishment in Greece has gotten away with murder. They have gotten away with being able to, you know, create artificial expectations, sell that to the EU, get all sorts of cash, and then not follow through in what they said they were going to do. There was a continuation of the austerity measures, and they were going to have cost cutting. They were going to raise taxes. They did not follow through. They did not follow through because not only because they couldn't or they didn't want to, but because there was so much dissension amongst the people and the citizens of Greece, and rightly so, that there was no way for them really to do so. So here's the pickle they find themselves in. Now, no matter what Greece says that they can do or hope to do, they almost have to believe, because if they were to allow a default of Greece, that would possibly create additional downside risk for Italy, Portugal, and Ireland. We'll leave Spain aside for a moment. That's a big problem, because the ECB can handle, they can handle Greece. They may not want to, but they can handle Greece. They really can't handle much more than that without going out and getting additional funding. Germany and their citizens is a political suicide for Merkel to come up with additional funding, because they don't want to bail out these economically insolvent countries at their expense. They're tired of it. So now you have the biggest banks of Germany and of France having incredible amounts of Greek debt that they really are having a problem with. But what they've done before was to buy more to prop it all up, and that house of cards will fall down sooner or later. Already this current tranche, this is what's happening right now, the current tranche of money that is supposed to be already voted on, already been voted on, and already been approved, is the money that is being said to be possibly held back. The latest stories that we're hearing late into the weekend is that they are going to possibly get part of the money they need to keep their funding through July. Through July. Talking about 10, 15 days. Because they have not been able to come up with the methodology to figure out how Greece is going to repay this debt. We're not even talking about the next amount that they need, which is over $160 billion, because they can't go to market with their current debt. Nobody's buying it. Or if they are buying it, it's at 25 and 30%. And that is not money that can be paid back very easily. And the ECB and the EU and the IMF all know this. The only money that could possibly have is very short-term notes they may be looking to issue on Monday of this week. And that's going to be about $1.5 billion in 13-week notes. So once again, not only kicking the can down the road, the stall tack that's being done is a really dangerous game, and that's what's been throwing markets into a tizzy. Because you have the currency movements, you have people being spooked about a global slowdown. And let me just say this. all those economists that came out in the last few months saying that, you've heard me say this before, there's going to be no slowdown and no effect on consumers due to the high price of oil, are the same ones that are saying, wow, the lower prices of oil right now that dropped from, whatever, 113 down to about 92, 93 very recently, is going to be really beneficial to the backdrop of consumer demand. Hey, fellas, you can't have it both ways. You can't say there's no problem if oil goes up, but it's beneficial if it goes down, right? At the same time, there was commentary that the Japan situation, the tsunami and earthquake and the supply chain slowdown, is not going to cause a problem. Well, it is. So I think that we need to get the economists' head out of the sand or wherever else they may have it up and come to some reality here that these global situations that arise have implications. And to believe that a Greek default will not have a much greater level of liquidity crisis and a much greater level of confidence crisis, and then spilling over into the other countries that also have weak balance sheets, if you will, is going to be a problem. And we see that with the VIX rising. The VIX kind of, that option that has this quote-unquote fear gauge built in that looks at what investors are looking at in the future as to the volatility potential. And usually volatility to the downside is the important issue, has been spiking dramatically. Whereas it really didn't move a lot for the first 3-4 weeks of this downturn in global markets, all of a sudden it started moving very quickly. Now with Friday's quadruple witching that went on, there was increased volume. When investors heard there was going to be a possible agreement, or at least it wasn't really an agreement with the ECB and Germany. It was more of a clarification that Germany realizes that they can't force any private investor to take less or to roll over the debt of Greece without causing a default. And if they default, there's a few things that happen. First of all, they're not going to be able to sell bonds at all. Second of all, you're going to trigger CDS payments. Now, I would just venture a bet that with all this money being borrowed, that there's been some buying and selling going on by these countries, and they have a chance of losing money as well on their CDS exposure because they felt very confident that they can contain the situation. And as such, if they can use the full amount of the piggy bank of their countries, why not sell the CDS to somebody else who thinks that the default may happen? And therefore, they may be at risk for significant amount of money, and their banks are at severe risk of losing a tremendous amount of money in a time where their economies are not doing as well. Germany aside here, there's been squeaking out some nice exports, but if you look at the internals, they've definitely slowed down. Now, with the quadruple witching on Friday, we saw an interesting thing happen. We saw that at first, with the idea that Germany's Chancellor Merkel would say, you know what, we're not going to require, and we don't think we should have, a mandatory rollover or have mandatory extensions by the private investors, but we would want to strongly suggest that there's a voluntary request to do so. Now, the problem with that is we still don't know that if any of the aspects of the bonds change that are due, or that if there is some, we'll call it coercion, to have any of these parties, the private parties, the banks, etc., to roll over or extend the maturities, if Fitch or Moody's or Standard & Poor's are going to require an automatic default rating. That's what the negotiations are all about. And of course, there's a series of meetings that are going to be happening Sunday, Monday, Tuesday or so, with Greece themselves, as well as the IMF, ECB, everybody's going to be going over this. So I think you're going to see conflicting stories out of Juncker from Luxembourg, and also you're going to hear from Merkel and Sarkozy, Trichet. They're all going to come out and try to play the game of, okay, what can we get away with here, at least to calm the markets so that we have some more time to breathe? I think that's really going to be a big issue. Because if you look at what's going to happen if they don't do so. I think they're scared recklessly. But unfortunately, they have not been able to, you know, create any kind of a, I think, a confidence that they understand what the depths of all this are. And that's really starting to come out. Italy was downgraded, or at least, I shouldn't say that. Italy was threatened to be downgraded last Friday. In the afternoon on Friday, all of a sudden, Italy's downgrade by Standard & Poor's was sitting out there saying, you know what? Their government, their programs are not doing what they have to be doing, because just like in Greece, you can't have austerity and cut down the payment of people, expect them to pay higher taxes in order to pay off debt at these levels. It just can't happen. I guess the only thing to say is you can't get water out of a rock. How much pain can you put on a person and then expect them to pay taxes on top of that? So all this is coming to the fore right now at the same time that we're seeing economic numbers slow down dramatically around the world. Manufacturing with the Philly Fed, the Empire State Fed, all the Fed manufacturing numbers that came in extremely disappointing last month. Goldman Sachs late Friday downgraded the second quarter GDP to about 2%. While the IMF still thinks it'll be anywhere from 3 to 4% on a global basis, but did acknowledge there was potential slowdown occurring. We're seeing that China is continuing to pull in the reins on their economy, their stock markets in the junker. And you're seeing that many of the emerging markets, like Brazil and India, and you look at Russia, what's going to happen now if oil prices don't stay up, and China are having a really difficult time containing the genie they let out of the bottle, which was the reinflation or reflation of their economies. They let this out. They don't know how to contain it. It's more like a monster than a genie. So right now, we're in a very precarious point because the Fed really does not want to continue quantitative easing programs outright and inflate their balance sheet any further. I don't think that they'll be handled very well politically. We have a deficit and a debt problem here in the United States. We have a currency crisis in Europe. We have an unknown nuclear event that continues in Japan, as well as a slowdown of the supply chain. We have the strongest countries trying to slow down all at the same time. And we have, on top of that, the idea that many of the banks are going to require additional amounts of capital to make sure they're solvent. And a lot of that is due to the fact that many officials did see that this continuation of the Greek drama, if you will, and the entire situation throughout much of Europe continues to degrade, and requiring banks to have a much greater level of overall stability is going to help them through some of this, which almost looks inevitable at this point. And you're seeing that many of the commodity traders are starting to lay off. Stocks are selling down. Yeah, they've been, from an index standpoint, rather subdued sell-offs. But if you've looked at any of the internal stocks, which we're going to get to after we talk to Harry Dent, you know, there was some real damage done to many of these charts. All right, let's take a break with that right now. We'll come back and talk about that. But now we have, as I talked to you about, we have Harry Dent. And Harry is, of course, as you know, the author of The Great Depression Ahead, some of the greatest books that I ever read back in the 1990s, the Roaring 2000s, etc. And I thought we'd get an update of what's going on. Harry, how are you?
Good.
So what's new? I mean, we talked last, and I think we talked about how there was a summertime problem that was brewing. So here we are.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've been warning for a long time. We knew the government was going to stimulate hard. We didn't think they'd go as far as QE1 and QE2, but, you know, there's going to be a bounce here after the first major crash and meltdown, but that it was going to keep failing because the demographics aren't behind it. Baby boomers are aging. They're moving into their 50s, and people there save more, spend less, and they certainly don't borrow money, and they certainly don't buy houses. In fact, they only tend to downsize from large houses to medium-sized houses, and they eventually end up in a nursing home. So, you know, that's the trend, and we've got unprecedented debt levels. I mean, everybody's focused on the $14 to $15 trillion government debt, and yeah, that's gone up $5 trillion since the crisis started and Obama came in, but That only went from 5 to 10 in the last decade. Private debt went from $20 trillion to $42 trillion, much more massive. And so, it's, you know, this private debt wants to deleverage. Businesses and consumers are too much in debt to borrow more, so the government keeps stimulating. It doesn't get lent. It doesn't get spent. All the money does is goes through the banks back into investment, and it's pumping up a bubble in stocks and commodities and everything else. And so we got a third bubble now that's going to burst in the next year or two. And the economy keeps coming up a little bit and then falling back. So as we're saying, we're taking a lot of Viagra and not much is happening. So I mean, I've seen polls recently saying, you know, 44 to 48% of people think we're going into a recession or depression in the next year. In other words, they're starting to see that the unprecedented stimulus program, with everything the government's thrown behind it, everything they have, the kitchen sink, every guarantee, quantitative easing, qualitative easing, zero interest rates, the economy's still basically dead, as we've said. So it's a matter now of when do the markets really get it that we're not going to go back to normal,
yeah,
and these deficits are only going to get worse, and these debts are not going to be able to be handled. So that happened in Europe last year, in Southern Europe, you know, April, May, and it happened overnight. The bond markets all of a sudden said, hey, we'll lend Greece money at 4.5%. Oops, no, now it's 12%, and of course today it's 18% on a 10-year bond and 30% on a 2-year. So once the bond markets, and they're the first to get it, realize that this is an untenable situation, they start penalizing you for further stimulus and irresponsible fiscal policies. Because, you know, the assumption is at first that, okay, if the government stimulates, yeah, it's going to cost some money and raise debt, but the economy will come back and businesses and consumers will do better and tax revenues will rise and the stimulus will be paid for. Well, this is not happening and it's not going to happen. So we're thinking we're getting closer, that sometime it'd be later this year, early next year, the stock market's going to top. Probably not going to go a lot higher, but probably going to go a bit higher from here. I think we're about to turn around from this correction. And then between 2012 and 13 or 14, we're going to see another major crash across the board. Real estate, commodities, gold, silver, oil, stocks, international, China, India, U.S., Europe. And it's going to be just like 2008, 2009, nowhere to hide. So if you're not defensive or if you're not betting against these markets, you're going to lose your, as we say, assets.
Yeah, I hear you. Let me just, I'm tightening the noose right now to get it ready because I'm pretty depressed at this point. But, you know, we need, by the way, you mentioned the Viagra kind of methodology where you get a short-term pop, we'll call it, right? And then nothing happens after that. We need those, you ever see the Cialis commercials? And it says, you know, if you have one that lasts 4 hours or more, that's what we need. We know those situations,
exactly.
You know? So here's a couple of questions I have for you. So the bond market gets it all of a sudden. Is it that the bond market and maybe even the equity market didn't want to get it? They knew it, but they didn't want to get it. And then on top of that, you had this whole issue of this confidence game that's being played by
yes.
all the players out there. I mean, have you ever in your career seen more of a parade of Fed and other officials talking about everything and contradicting each other, but at the end of the day, almost the last one that speaks is the one that nixes everybody else's opinion?
Yeah, no, that's exactly what it is, Andrew. It is, I call it denial. And anything that's unacceptable to a person or a culture or an institution, when, you know, a company that's, you know, in trouble, the first thing is denial. Well, it's not really that bad. Or Wiener, no, it really wasn't my, you know, blah, blah, blah. Or I got hacked. You know, it's always denial. And then the reality eventually sets in. And then, as we see today, a guy like Wiener has to step down. I mean, we, from our point of view, we've never hedged on this. We've never said, like Rubini said recently, well, 1 out of 3 chance, and if that, that of a depression or a downturn, and if this, and if the government. No, we're like saying there's no way out of this. We let the bubble go too far. Demographics have turned against the markets and the economy. We've been predicting that for 20 years. That's a natural cycle. And so at some point, the markets and everybody, and like you say, it's all rah, rah, rah. It's not just, it's the Fed, it's the president, but it's all these stockbrokers and financial institutions, and it's the media. CNBC is on there every day, like, rah, 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 we do the right thing.
So
like you say, the whole thing, everybody's thinking, if we just keep the confidence up long enough and if people don't panic, we'll get back to normal, and then we can pay off these debts and everything will be okay. There is no getting back to normal with baby boomers aging. There's no getting back to normal with 60-some trillion in unfunded entitlements and 42 trillion in private debt and 15 trillion in government debt and growing. There's no, we have to deal with deleveraging this debt. And the best way to bring cash flow back to baby boomers that are aging and have less income and less spending is to relieve them of their debt. We need to restructure debt in this country that went wild in the last decade. So that's going to be painful at first, like the Great Depression, but it pays big long-term dividends. Imagine, yeah. I mean, we got $20 trillion in private debt that could be eliminated to get back in line with real assets and values. We got out of 60-some trillion in entitlements, we could cut at least a third of those just by being common sense and restricting and not letting people have a $500,000 operation when they're going to only live another 6 months. And not, you know, a lot of things you can do, having people retire a little later and you know, means testing some benefits. There's a lot of things could be done, but nobody wants to do it in good times. And the public is concerned about the debt and the deficits. You see that in every poll. But 78% or something like that, more than agree on anything, said don't cut our health care, Medicare, Medicaid. Well, sorry, it's going to be cut. It has to be cut.
You know, one of the things that you talk about a lot and we talk about is this whole, and I think it's a cornerstone, or maybe even the foundation, better said, of some of your work, which is the whole age and demographic economic discussion. You know, one of the things that I think is really interesting, and you probably know this, I think you know this, is when you study biology in high school. Now, I know this because my son just finished his biology course, and lo and behold, I come across this chapter with him as we're going through some, you know, going back and forth on his testing and preparation, something called the age structure diagram. I never saw it presented this way. You've seen these before, Harry? You know what I'm talking about?
No.
These are really cool.
We study all types of stuff like that.
I got to send you this because this is stuff that's taught in ninth grade biology, okay? And it shows basically an age structure diagram. And I'm looking at one right now. You can just look it up on the internet, age structure diagram. And it shows the population spread and dispersion of ages, okay, and male and female. So, for example—
Oh, yeah. We look at that all
right. Right. So what's interesting is this book, this ninth grade biology book, is explaining how—I'm not kidding— because it's all about not only this human population, it's about, you know, biology and animal population. It shows like the rapid growth, Kenya, Nigeria, Saudi Arabia, because you have such a young population that's reproducing, et cetera, et cetera. And then you go to the right and you look at like zero growth. And the diagram looks entirely different for Denmark, Austria, and Italy.
Oh, yeah, totally.
All I'm saying, though, is what
Italy also looks different for China versus India.
Right.
People don't realize how much difference there is there.
What I guess I don't understand is this is ninth grade biology. Ninth grade biology that dates back, by the way, this is early evolution stuff, right? Why isn't it that the people that are in charge of the economy ever even looking at this stuff? Or is it just something that is just there and it's, oh, well, that's what it is?
Well, I mean, we took demographics more from social sciences and marketing. People in marketing, it's the holy grail. But people in economics and in broad business and politics, they don't understand it. So, I mean, we've been around 20 years preaching this gospel about demographics. We said 20 years ago the economy was going to start to slow around 2008 and slow for over a decade. And people are like, oh, yeah. I don't know, but, it's more the Federal Reserve policy and innovation. But, you know, they have all this other stuff they've learned in school. Economists don't want to look at demographics because they don't understand it. They don't want that to be the holy grail. And we've found for the economy, it is the holy grail. It drives inflation, disinflation, deflation, spending, saving, investment, debt. Every sector of our economy, whether people are buying light trucks or minivans or luxury cars or small cars, I mean, you know, starter homes, trade-up homes, vacation homes, apartments, I mean, it is the holy grail for the economy. We've been able to see so many things, but economists just sit there and say, no, well, this was because the Fed didn't do this, or this because the government didn't do this, or this is because Japan had a hiccup. You know, they just don't get it, and you know what? They won't. I've tried to argue with these people. They learned this at Yale. This is the way it is. It's like me going, Galileo, going to the church of the Catholic Church and the whenever the 1400s and saying, guess what, you know, the universe doesn't revolve around us.
I have a question.
It's just nobody wanted to hear it.
So here's a question for you. Is there any way for you to do, or maybe you've done, this already, because the globalization and the world being a smaller place with the transportation being upgraded and internet and phones and communication, have you ever done a kind of evolution of the global, entirely, the entire global age map, if you will, to see what the global economies are going to be looking like? Is that a more stable?
No, we do that. In the Great Depression, we had our longest chapter. The publisher almost made me cut it out. It was so long. It's like 60 pages or something. We looked at the whole world. We looked at innovation on a 22-year lag to the world population, young people coming out of college. We looked at spending peak in the mid-40s for the globe. We looked at different major regions and key countries around the world. I mean, people think India and China are two emerging countries going to grow forever. Well, India is going to grow forever. China isn't going to grow past the next couple of years before they start to slow down in workforce growth, and they only have to rely on moving people from farms to cities, which will still be a growth avenue. But, hey, it's the young people that move from farms to cities more than the older people, and their aging society will even slow that down.
Right.
So China and India do not have the same trajectory ahead. Neither do Russia or Brazil. Brazil is much more bullish than Russia. So, yeah, different countries and regions are very different. Most of the developed countries, Europe, United States, Australia, New Zealand, Japan, are on a similar peaking long-term in demographics and a kind of a sideways to downward movement. Most emerging countries are growing for decades ahead, but some of them are growing for one decade, some of them are growing for 6 or 8 decades. But, yeah, we can look at this demographic potential for spending, workforce growth, inflation, innovation in any major country or region around the world.
All right, last thing is this. You talk about this whole, the depression, or this next round of what's going to occur in the economy. First of all, very simply, I think it's a quick one. Is this on a global basis, or is this limited to just, let's say, Europe and U.S.?
No, actually, it's triggered by the Europe and U.S., the developed countries. They're the ones that have the slowing demographics and the greatest real estate and debt bubbles and stuff. But the emerging countries have grown extremely fast, exporting to us. China has one of the greatest bubbles in the world. They're building cities for millions, nobody in them. They're just building them to employ people and keep people happy, assuming they're going to need the capacity in the future. They're building industrial capacity, aluminum, cement, all this stuff, way more than they need for the markets today, just assuming the global market's going to grow and their market's going to grow. They're on an incredible bubble in a different way. It's not through consumer borrowing. It's through government just pushing development and funding the development. And once the world slows down and we slow down further, China's going to bust as well. And China doesn't have the demographics to come roaring back out of this like India or Malaysia or many countries in Asia. They are slowing in demographics faster. China's demographics for spending in the future slow faster than the U.S. Not as fast as Europe or Japan, but faster than the U.S.
I think every time I think about the ghost towns of China, I can only think of one thing. They are going to make the greatest locations for a laser tag game ever.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I'm saying?
Exactly. Empty places. Yeah.
Yeah, paintball.
Or for the military to have places to bomb, do bombing practice
right,
or whatever.
Right. Exactly. All right. So finally, is the whole issue of the European situation, we don't know this answer, but the whole Greece thing is just a disaster, but it's just the tip of the iceberg, and that's why they can't let the iceberg melt at this point.
Exactly. They know it's defunct. They know it's going to have to default. They're pushing it down the road because they don't want it to spread to Ireland, Portugal, Spain, and Belgium, and all these other countries, and Hungary. And it's really stupid because they're just putting on band. It's the same thing as the Fed. The Fed's putting in trillions in the economy, running trillions of debt, hoping then in a couple of years we get back to normal and then we can slowly pay this off. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen in Europe either. So Europe's making a huge mistake. But you know what? They're probably going to come up with something for Greece despite all the arguing. Of course the Germans don't want to fund the Greeks, who don't pay taxes and don't work. They don't do either. But they almost have to keep the whole European Union together in the European Central Bank, and that's unfortunate.
Well, I've said this before to other people, and in closing, I'll say it to you. I think I do have the solution to Greece, seriously. I have the solution what they can do. There's two beautiful islands, Santorini and Mykonos. I don't know if you've been there. But they could sell those. First of all,
Crete. I think they have ownership in Crete.
Yeah.
Sell those islands. Right. It's tough for them long-term in tourism, but it's true. That is their biggest asset because they don't have anything else. They don't have major industry.
Right.
They don't lead in much. And they have an aging population. I mean, that southern European nations outside of Japan, that the real aging parts of the world are Russia, East Europe, and southern Europe.
Right.
They are just, after the next decade, they're going to age so fast. they're going to basically go back to nothing. It could be like Rome turning into Italy and Greece turning into Greece today. Rome and Greece used to dominate the world. Now they're just minor European countries, you know, with goat farmers.
Oh, yeah. Well, we'll see. I mean, I don't know about you, but if we could do, I'm hoping that maybe it's possible that Buffett through his NetJets will do some kind of a sharing deal. I'm in for a piece of Santorini. I don't know about you.
I know.
I get a piece.
If I was them, I agree with you. You have to, at this point, they've gone so far to keep from having to so severely cut the benefits of their population, who's only going to keep on riding because they're spoiled. Yes, it's better to sell assets like that, which are a long-term asset, and it's going to hurt them long-term, but it's better than having riots for the next decade.
And by the way, this is no different than a simple repossession of a bad credit situation.
Yeah.
I mean, because people are like, what do you mean you're going to sell land? What are you going to do? What? I mean,
so it's like a Chapter 11.
That's all it is.
You restructure your debts with creditors, you sell off some assets, and you get back into operation again.
Right. The only other thing they probably sell, and we'll just leave it at this, is probably the trademark to the word gyro. But other than that, I'm not sure what else we get, you know?
And they maybe don't have a lot.
All right. Harry Dent, author of The Great Depression of Head. Of course, you go to hsdent.com. He has a great couple of newsletters that are out there, some training courses as well. He has seminars that tell you about what's going on, some market timing models. Great stuff. You know, I love you, Harry, and I hope to see you soon.
Okay. Thanks, Andrew.
All right. Have a good one. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. Harry Dent right there says that it looks like we could have a bounce, and then there'll be a drawdown, as there has been, and we have to look out for the next level of this entire process that's going to unfold here. Interesting. I would really recommend checking out his books. Interesting stuff. Even if you don't go as far as thinking there may be a depression, et cetera, I think it's worthwhile to have all this information at hand. Education is one of the best ways to really get ahead in terms of understanding the bigger picture with these markets. So think about that. You can pick up my book, by the way, over at Amazon, The Disciplined Investor, Essential Strategies for Success. You also have the ability to listen to our other podcast, The Winning Investor, also available on iTunes, or DH Unplugged, which I do with John C. Dvorak. Now, before we got to the discussion with Harry Dent, I mentioned some of the things that are also happening. I think we'll start with the idea that next week's Fed minutes are going to be important. We'll see the release of the Fed minutes and the interplay of what happened with some of the Fed leaders and come up with, you know, what was their thinking here? What will they be doing? Any hints about further stimulus or laying off on interest rate moves? And that's going to be a big market mover towards the middle of the week. And I think one of the things that we really need to look at is how there has been an incredible sell-off distribution in things like many of the high-quality China stocks. The lower quality names that did these reverse mergers that we've talked about before, where they came into the market and were looking to easily get in through, it used to be called a blind pool, create a company and then had some kind of product they were dealing with and be listed on the U.S. exchanges for trading by investors. They've really fallen, I mean, dramatically. You look at a Sina, Sohu, a Baidu. You know, you look at the C-Trips, you look at these names that have had extraordinary growth and appear to be real companies, and just taking Sina as an example, goes from recently as high as 140 down to about 80, and a few days really sold off. You look at these situations of the smaller ones, like the Renrens and the Sino Forest, and you look at, the Sino Forest. You look at also, for example, the Smart Heat and the Rhino. I mean, these things went down 75, 80, 90%, and some of them were even delisted because there's a big concern out there that there's a lot of fraud going on. Now, whether there is or there isn't, the question remains, is the fraud, even on a one-company basis, constrained and contained to that one company? Or is there a much bigger situation out there? Do we really think that Baidu is that much of a shell game? I don't know. Seems hard to believe. Do we really believe that there is a concern with regard to Ascena, NetEase? They've had extraordinary looking balance sheets and they've had excellent looking earnings. And is that all a giant sham? I don't know, but we really have to be aware of this because we're talking about a massive amount of ownership of these things. And if there is, especially with the hedge fund world and the mutual fund world, and if we're going to see people like Paulson being taken out for $250 million on this Sinoforest deal, if we're going to see major hedge funds and mutual funds start to have to go out and not only sell these things, but sell at any cost, the question is going to be two things. Number one, what effect is that going to have on the rest of the markets? When you see anyone running out and having to sell, oftentimes they sell a lot of things because they don't want to have the inability to have liquidity. The second thing is that if they do this, is there some of the baby being thrown out with the bathwater? Would it be a great opportunity to buy a Sina, a Baidu, a C-Trip? You know, these are these places that are really going to be beneficial, or are they just going to be, you know, thrown to the side? It would seem like a Baidu, Sina, Sohu, NetEase, again, to some names, and again, I'm not recommending any of these. I'm just saying those are the names that are more the quote-unquote quality names that we've known about, although quality is coming into question now. But these are names that may be the bathwater and babies discussion. So just think about that. Keep that on your radar screen. Keep that somewhere that you could see what's going on and track them. I think that would be very important to take a look at over time and see if they're starting to move. They'll usually move together. We saw Research in Motion get absolutely obliterated last week, where I almost thought there was nowhere lower the stock could go. I will tell you, their earnings came in, and they made it on EPS. But their revenue was short, and their outlook was absolutely abysmal. Now, I spent some time listening to the conference call, and I may actually put that up on the Disciplined Investor site. I wrote up a piece on this and kind of the notes on conference calls that we do for internal discussion here and to follow things. And one of the things that I really was pretty surprised of was the arrogance of management and the lack of their ability to change and to adapt to the circumstance around them. Now, that may not happen very quickly with management of any company, but this is going on a few years now, and it's very reminiscent of what happened with Ed Zander over at Motorola, where he couldn't adapt after he came out with that blockbuster phone, the Razr. Remember that one? He just couldn't adapt. And the problem was that once the Razr outlived its usefulness, and there was a new revolution of phones that came out, a la the BlackBerry at that time, that was the smartphone of the day then, they just lost market share and the company just really imploded. They could do nothing right at that point because they were in the same mindset. This management seems to be very stubborn. I even went back to past commentary on several different past conference calls, and I was very interested to find out how the comments of stubborn management needs to change their ideals, management needs to come off their high horse, and all these comments were flowing around in the last several commentaries, if you will, or the overviews of conference calls. So nothing's really changing there. Will the company be bought out? The rumors circulate. But I'll tell you something. If everything stays the same thing with this company will not survive. They have talked about their latest product that they're not going to be able to provide and bring to market in the right time. And I just wonder, even if this Q, you know, this new QNX platform they have is so great, are they so late to the party that they've allowed Google and Apple and even Microsoft to get so far ahead of them that there's no turning back at this point? In other words, the velocity that has been created is just leaving them so far behind that they can never catch up. I do think there's something to be said about that. The other thing I want to talk about is I think this is important in a discussion that we should have about what's happening, particularly with the S&P, the Dow, and what the outlook is. Right now we know that we're in a downtrend, right? There's no question about that. I don't think anybody has a question about that. At least it's a short-term downtrend and a longer-term bull market. But I'll tell you something. Some of the things that we're seeing right now in terms of the velocity, if you will, and the level of selling and the intensity of selling is much different than we saw in the last two or three drops and downtrends within this same trend. right now what we're seeing is a much larger potential slide. And just to give you some numbers here, there's an important level at 1250 for the S&P 500, which is, you know, not far away, 1%, 1.5% overall. And then from there, the problem is there's a bit of a gap. You go down to 1224 and then 1190 and so on and a few other points below that. So we're talking about another, you know, give or take 8 to 10% from here. That seems to be that point. Now, with that in mind, does that really make sense? We're looking at the technicals here. And technicals are important because even if you have the greatest fundamentals in the world like we did back in 2007, there are a lot of outside conditions that will press upon the forward-looking situation when it comes to equities. So when you're a fundamental investor, you're really focusing on the quality of the company earnings and their ability to do so not only historically and what they've done, but the outlook. The problem is that the outlook changes. And oftentimes, when we look at earnings results, we look at a linear outlook by analysts. We look at what they've done before and what we think they'll do. Now, you have to take in consideration some of the external conditions that will push on this. So you have, like we mentioned, we have the situation in Japan. We have the situation in Europe. We have now central banks tightening. The potential for the dollar to move up in value due to many of the concerns that are out there with the global markets and the potential for a currency and sovereign risk default. And you look at this and you have to look at the fundamentals differently. While a lot of analysts are still predicting 95 to 105 next year on the S&P 500 for total earnings, if you just simply do a average PE ratio and use a very simplistic approach, you could say, well, by the end of 2012, the S&P should be about 1,500, easy target to come up with. Unfortunately, that doesn't take into consideration all the things that allowed earnings to be so good that may be, in fact, reversing. For example, if the Fed doesn't do additional quantitative easing and if they are forced to keep their interest rates either as they are because they can't go lower, or raise them ever so slightly, that changes the entire outlook. In fact, if you really think about this, over the last several years, we had a declining interest rate environment as well as, the word is not even incredible, it's historic. Historic stimulus measures from around the world in a concerted effort and a coordinated effort to rebuild the economies. The problem with this is that's probably not going to happen. You already have, with all the austerity talk and all the need to cut down on overall deficits and GDP to deficit ratios, et cetera, around the world, you have Europe, of all places, talking up the game that they're going to increase interest rates. I don't think so. Increasing interest rates would be economic suicide in Europe. Now, when we look at these targets and you look at the downside risk of this market right now, I'm not talking about one day, two day, here and there. You get a nice bump because all of a sudden we have one piece of economic news that looks better. Everybody was excited on Friday about the leading indicators were up 0.8 when they thought they should have been, at least expectations were, for a 0.4. And when I saw that number come out, I was scratching my head. I said, wait a minute. Leading indicators are from the month before, by the way. And classically, most of the information is known prior to the release. I think there's only one small component that is not known. How did the analysts get this so wrong? It's stupidity. And unfortunately, what happens is that everybody gets all excited at seeing a news item come out with a headline number, and they start bidding up stocks. But you know what? It was time to clearly short into that rally on Friday. And it came down all the way. Last minute gasp of buying was put in to make sure that the S&P was up for the week, 0.04, so that we could say, hey, we broke the bad trend. And of course, getting the Dow over 12,000 by 4 points. Oh, the Dow's over 12,000. These are all for effect. keeping the confidence up. That's what this is, all a giant confidence game. We've talked about that ad nauseum. But when you look at what's actually happening around the world, it's very unfortunate that the every breath and comment from the fork-tooth tellers in the Eurozone is really what's been really the drivers here. The dollar is on an upward path right now. It may not be forever, but it does clearly look like it's bottomed. And it does look like it has that bottoming pattern going in. And it would be very interesting to see, you know, if that takes hold and what's going to happen to the rest of the commodity complex. We talked to you about our silver discussion and silver staying within a range. You have to watch that 100-day moving average. If it pops over that, it could see a little bit of a rise, and you have to be careful with that. But up until that point, it's silver is clearly in a projected downtrend right now. That has a lot more to go, a lot more silver to be let loose of by those that overinvested. And then oil, just look at what's going on there. Demand has clearly been cut. You see that it, right now, Japan just comes out with a negative 10% export growth just printed. And there was an expectation of only a negative 8. Now, of course, the Nikkei, that market has nothing to do with reality. That market is all about the movement of the yen and the money that's going in as, everybody just thinks that it can't go down anymore. But the fact is that, you know, we're seeing time and time again that the Nikkei has been hurt here with the nuclear situation and by their twisting of the truth over at TEPCO, which has been broadcast loud and clear by the government of Japan to have occurred. And now what we're seeing is that people think this is a great opportunity. Again, buying on the dips has not gotten anybody anywhere. When we wrote about Japan and our concerns there, it was trading at about, the Nikkei was trading at about 9,700. That was a few months ago. Now it's at like 9,300, 9,400. So you have to be really concerned, I think, with that whole investment thesis that it's a great time to buy Japan because prices are lower. The problem with that is that they may go even lower than that. Right? Make sense? Very simple. The underlying fundamentals are not supportive. If you look at them in a geometric rather than a linear equation and saying that, well, there's going to be a lot more fallout due to the nuclear fallout. And there's going to be a continuation of a slowdown there as the world slows down. It's a very simple equation. That may have nothing to do with the little moves here and there of the equity markets. But yet at the same time, I think we have to be very aware of watching many of the pundits on TV that come on and say they're just buying something because it's down. You don't forget that you had Paulson come out and say he was very supportive of his Sino-Forest position after it was down 78%. I mean, that's kind of a little weird, isn't it? Very supportive of the position. We think there's nothing to it. Meanwhile, another report comes out this weekend that says, hey, you know what? There was an independent study done that Sino-Forest did, in fact, overstate their holdings. Then you have the rush to get the IPOs out. You know, the Pandora comes out, it goes up, it comes down, LinkedIn comes in, up and then down. And on top of all this, we have the continuation of the fight on the budget and the, I don't even know what's going on in Washington anymore. It's a circus. Absolute circus. So all this right now is going to continue this volatility. So keep on your toes. There's going to be an opportunity where we'll see a mini rally in all of this. We're getting close to it, I think. In fact, I think that probably the mini rally is going to be somewhere in the neighborhood of, we'll call it beginning-ish of July, up until the first earnings. Alcoa, we usually see a little bit of a turn from wherever we've been. So if the market has been up, you may see a downturn into the first earnings, into the first week of earnings to get some position squaring going on. Well, we've seen a big drop here over the last several weeks. In fact, in the month of June, we've seen, I think, the worst drop in probably a year and change on a monthly basis to date. Down about 8% and a negative territory on the Russell, NASDAQ, 6% on the S&P, 5% on the Dow, somewhere around there. month to date, pretty substantial numbers. And a lot of stocks have been hurt on the way down, much more than the indices. So when you look at this situation now, remember that, you know, it's never too late to, you know, get away from, I just hope things are going to get better. Remember that there are downside risk techniques that you could use, and we've talked about them for the last few years. Right now, we have a very low position in equities. We have a lot of hedging of a variety of indices in a portfolio. And that's the way we feel comfortable at this moment. Until we could see signs that there is buying going on, there has not been buying going on. There has not been any long buying going on. There's just distribution and selling into any strength. That is clearly what's going on here domestically. So positions are being brought down all over the place and on an institutional basis. Unfortunately, the volume has not been there, so institutions have to walk very carefully through this minefield. But if they really start selling, we're going to see a real bad, ugly day out there coming up. There'll be a day that all of a sudden things break down, whether it's right at that 1250 or below that level, that all of a sudden we see all those triggered sells, those automatic sell programs go into effect. And then all of a sudden you're going to see a real ugly situation because of the lack of liquidity in these markets, especially in the summertime. So just something to think about. So that's where we have a decidedly, we'll say, a negative view right now on the global economic circumstance, situation, whatever you want to call it. We also have a negative outlook on the markets in general. Some stocks we like. There's definitely some stocks we like out there. But at the same time, you know, you have to be very careful because in these kind of conditions, stocks will fall even if they're, quote unquote, good, fundamentally strong stocks. So you have to pare back positions and look at your position sizing. So if you usually would have, let's say, a 4%, 5% core position in your portfolio, maybe have 2.5%, 3%, maybe. Cut it back. You can always get back in. Don't be shy. Or cut it back to 1%. We took down over the last several weeks a lot of our positions. A lot of our colleagues have done the same thing. Institutions have clearly done the same thing. And you'll notice that when you see that big move up and then it come back, what that is a sign of is hedge funds and day traders moving in and out of markets for the daily effect. So just realize that's what's going on. And don't get all hot under the collar to get in before anybody else. It's okay to get in a little later, just a little bit. It's okay. Wait for confirmation signals. Wait for the confirmation signals. We're seeing the markets, yes, get a little exhausted from the sell side, from the selling side, but that doesn't mean they can't continue to go down. They may see a little bit of a rise and, you know, sellers will lay off for a little while because they want the market to, you know, not get too oversold and to a point that people are fed up and just thrown in the towel. Because if institutions, they're smart, they're patient. If they want to unload shares, they'll do it over time and not, or at least attempt not to knock the markets down, at least in the initial stages. So that's what we have when it comes to this market condition right now. And I think you have to look at the leaders like the Apples, look at Caterpillar, look at the names that have been leading the market on the way up. And what are they doing now? Look at the energy stocks and the rotation out of those. Look at the utilities and how there's been a rotation into those. So these are big issues that you need to be confronting right now and looking at a realistic view of the world. Probably the first time that we've seen this kind of view in the last 2 years. Things have changed. Central banks are not as accommodative. There is a lot more instability, a lot more coming to the edge for the euro. The can has been kicked. Now it's time to kind of collect. So we'll see how that plays out because, you know, these witty fellas over in Europe in terms of their central banks are awfully smart at creating something that can continue the process for some time. But I'd be hard-pressed to believe that the Greek prime minister will be able to really convince that he'll be able to pull off these unbelievable austerity measures to get the next loan package. I'd be very surprised. Anyway, we talked about that ad nauseum. We have Mark Farber from the Gloom, Doom, and Boom Report coming up in the next couple of weeks. We have
Who else do we have? We have a couple other people that we lined up. I'm drawing a blank here. Some of the usual guys will be back. We'll talk with them. We'll bring Frank Curzio back in the next few weeks. We always got to talk with Frank about what's going on in his world. And then from there, we will actually kind of be in the middle of the summer already. In the middle of the summer. Amazing. Anyway, thanks for joining me today. Any questions that you have, of course, you can. And thanks for listening to all my ranting and raving about what's going on. But I got to tell you, I've had enough. I'm not taking it anymore with this whole European situation. I think you stay away from that currency for at least till they can settle out whatever's going on. But anyway, if you do want to contact me for whatever reason, tell me I'm a blowhard or to, you know, say, hey, great stuff or whatever you want to say. AskAndrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com is the address to do so. And if you haven't done so already, check out the virtual tour over at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. There's a little note in the show notes where you can find that. And we hope that you have a very successful, profitable week. We'll see you next week with lots of information on what to do. And when the markets do turn correctly, we'll have some good ideas on maybe some stocks that look ripe for the picking. Till then, I'll see you soon. Thanks for joining me.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.